Hi, I'm Gary, and this is episode 267 of EV Musings, a podcast about renewables, electric vehicles, and things that are interesting to electric vehicle owners. On the show today, we'll be going back to basics in the first of a series of episodes I like to call EV 101. This season of the podcast is sponsored by ZapMap, the go-to app for EV drivers, helping you find and pay for public charging with confidence. Tusker Salary Sacrifice Car Scheme. It's an affordable way to drive electric via an employer benefits scheme. A complete car package, including insurance, MOTs, replacement tyres, routine servicing and maintenance, as well as full breakdown cover. All for a fixed monthly amount and with no deposit or upfront payments. Now, our main topic of discussion today is EV basics, and this is the first of three episodes in a short series that I've put together for you. Across this series, we're going to be going back and laying out the whole EV thing for absolute beginners. So let me explain, because I think a little bit of explanation is in order. Now, I've been putting out podcast episodes now for about 7 years, and across 260 plus episodes, I've covered all sorts of EV-related topics from your first day with an EV, charging, roaming, the grid, the AA, range anxiety, driving long distances, insurance, charge safety, tyres, fires, everything. If there's a topic related to electric vehicles, there's a very good chance I've got an episode on it, or even two if it's an episode in a fast-moving part of the sector. But if you're someone sitting outside the EV sphere or bubble and you're thinking about getting an EV, it can look like a complicated thing to get right. I mean, we've got charge curves and preconditioning and roaming cards and the Public Charge Point Regulations 2023, not to mention expensive public charging, CCS, CHAdeMO, fast charging, rapid charging, ultra-rapid charging. I mean, who wants to sit and listen to 260 episodes of a podcast to learn enough to be able to drive a car? It's all so complicated, right? So over the next three fairly short digestible episodes, we're bringing it back to basics. What do you absolutely need to know before you get your EV? How do you choose your EV? And what do you need to do on day one? We're going to be talking about the following things. Who should and probably shouldn't go electric right now? Different ways to get an EV, so hiring, leasing, buy, new, second-hand, salary sacrifice. We're going to be talking about the test drive, what to do and what not to do. We're going to be looking at home charging or not. And we're going to be looking at taking delivery and driving your car, regen braking, high power, the apps you need, etc. And we'll be looking at charging your car at home or on the street. We'll be looking at doing a long-distance journey, and we'll be looking at charging your car on a public charger. Now, we'll split these topics up across three episodes so you can focus in on the one you really need to answer your specific question. Now, in this episode, we'll be discussing who should get an electric car, should it be new or used. We'll be looking at leasing, buying, and test driving. In the next episode, we'll assume you've got your car and it's either arrived on the back of a low loader or you've gone to pick it up from a dealer. And in the final episode, number three, we'll look at public charging and driving a long distance in your EV. So let's get started. So the first thing we want to talk about is who should and probably shouldn't go electric right now. Now, whilst I would love everyone to be driving around in an electric car, the truth is that at the moment, there are use cases where an electric car isn't quite right for everyone just now. The big question you need to ask yourself is whether you can park your car off street and gain access to an electricity source. Now, if you can, then it's well worth getting an electric vehicle. If you can't, so you might live in a terraced house, then it's not the end of the world. It's more to do with what's the local charging infrastructure like nearby. Do you have a workplace that has chargers? Do you live in one of the cities that's added pavement charging everywhere so you can hook up overnight? So, take an honest look at your situation and make the decision. Now, I know many people with no home charging. They make use of public charging infrastructure via payment chargers or en route chargers, and we'll talk about those a little later. In fact, I did a whole episode about those EV drivers in season 11, episode 290, if you want to check that out. You can also get access to a home charge if your car is parked
on a pavement outside your house via a device such as a gully or turbocharge, which is a channel installed across the pavement into which your charging cable can sit without being a trip hazard. There are other alternatives, such as the charge bridge by Nodum that threads the cable over people's heads in a lamppost style arrangement across the pavement. And again, we talked about both of these in episode 214. Now, if you live in an apartment and it has underground parking and more than 30 spaces, you can look at a company such as Charge Guru, who provide a charging service as needed by liaising directly with your landlord. And we spoke about this in episode 226. Now, if none of these apply to you, and there's no local charging infrastructure you can use, and no workplace charging, then you should probably think about delaying the transition to electric for a while until the situation changes. But that's not the only thing that plays into this. Let's talk about your use case. Do you drive hundreds and hundreds of miles every day, needing to carry a half a ton in the back, towing a trailer or a caravan? What about if you're someone who only buys 5th, 6th, 7th hand cars and you never want to spend more than about, I don't know, £500, and then you'll run them right into the ground? Now, both of these scenarios are outside the range of electric vehicles right now, but this will change. Although former guest of the podcast, Dr. Ewan McTurk, did calculations once that proved that even if somebody gave you a free car, a free petrol car, it can end up costing more than an electric vehicle due to fuel savings, servicing savings, etc. Remember, purchase price is just a small part of the cost of running a car. Add up the total of cost, insurance, servicing, vehicle excise duty, fuel, and compare the values for EV and petrol, especially if you have off-street parking. What I would also caution you not to do is to buy an EV based on the longest journey you do in a given year. I had someone tell me once that he'd never buy an EV because he drove to the south of France every year on holiday and he could do it in one tank of diesel and no EV can do that. Well, apart from the fact that he's incorrect about the fact no EV can do it, YouTuber Andrew Till has done the UK to Rome run in multiple EVs quite easily. The comparison of one tank of diesel to multiple charge stops is not a great one, and we'll cover that in a later episode. Just remember that, as Jack Scarlett said on this very podcast, you wouldn't buy your shoes based on the fact that you go skiing once a year, so you'll need ski boots. So why buy your car the same way? The other thing to avoid doing is buying a car based on the manufacturer's stated range, and that's what's called the WLTP range, and it's calculated using a rather esoteric set of criteria. The range that comes from it is neither accurate nor reliable. It's meant purely as a means of doing a comparison between different vehicles. I released an episode earlier this season that discusses WLTP, the standard for vehicle range evaluation, and why it shouldn't be relied on. So check that out if you're interested in more detail. Now, my advice to you is to go to a site such as the evdatabase.org, put in your potential car and look at the real-world ranges they display for you. The values shown there are more reliable than the WLTP ranges. These show ranges you can expect in warm weather and cold weather, because it's different, around town, on a run, on a motorway. Now, if you regularly need a car that will easily take you on a 250-mile motorway trip without a problem, find one where the cold weather highway range gets close to that. Don't rely on manufacturer's WLTP range to guide you. But if you only do this trip once in a blue moon, buying a car with a large battery that will meet that need is both expensive, because bigger batteries mean more expensive EVs, and it's a bit of a waste, because you'll be hauling around batteries you don't need for 99% of the time, when you're not actually doing that 200-plus-mile trip. So let's assume you've looked at your criteria, you've decided that you can work with an electric car, and you're now looking to see how to get one on your drive. Let's look at that. The different ways you could get an EV: hiring, leasing, buying, new, second-hand, salary sacrifice. Now, we'll assume you're in the large proportion of the population who can feasibly move to electric. The next thing you'll need to look at is how you get there. What are the ways of getting an electric vehicle on your drive? Well, there are actually quite a few of them. Let's start with the really easy ones. You can hire them. There are companies such as Zimble in Banbury, and we've had them on the show, and Europe Car Nationwide, we've had them on the show, and they'll rent you an electric car with everything included for you to see if you like it. In fact, Europe Car will even lease you one on a monthly basis, including insurance and servicing, and all you need to do is get the electricity to fuel it. Now, it's probably a great way to see whether it works for you. Back in the day when I was young, there were things like the Electric Vehicle Experience Center that were brand agnostic, and it would loan EVs for a weekend or 4 days, complete with a charging card, so it cost you nothing to charge, and you could try them out. And that's how I got my first electric vehicle. It was fantastic. Unfortunately, the EVEC is no longer around, and perhaps the concept should be reinstated, who knows? The next way of getting an electric car, and one that's increasingly popular for the cost-saving aspect, is salary sacrifice, or SALSAC.
Yes, so I'm Cheryl Clements. I'm Head of Business Development at Tusker Direct.
Wonderful. Now, we're here to talk about salary sacrifice. So if I was to ask you to give me a quick sort of 15-second pitch for salary sacrifice, what would that be, please?
So salary sacrifice allows employers to provide cars to their employees as part of employee benefits, green cars, so electric cars and hybrids as well, and also make tax and NI savings for the employee, as well as the employer making employer's NI savings on the cars.
And who specifically is it designed for? Because it's not everybody who's employed. So like I'm employed, but I'm self-employed. So can I get a salary sacrifice offering?
Typically not, no. It would be companies that have a number of employees with employee benefits in place. And it's typically something that's done through salary sacrifice and employee benefits portals. So it doesn't tend to work for individuals as such.
What is it that salary sacrifice offers that me going out and getting a lease car of my own or buying a car of my own doesn't give? What's the USP for a salary sacrifice?
Definitely the tax and NI savings on the gross reduction that's coming out of salary, which is great, as long as the car is 75 grams of CO2 and below. But it's more about tapping into the leasing company that's providing it. So the provider, they get really good discounts from manufacturers and dealers because they're buying a lot of volume. There's discounted motor insurance, discounted servicing, maintenance, and that sort of thing. So all of that coming out discounted from gross reduction and then making tax NI savings, they're currently, from our dealings, there is no cheaper way of getting an employee into one of these cars.
So do you have sort of some ballpark figures for what this would look like for, say, a base rate taxpayer? How would that actually work? What would that look like on their, you know, from the bottom line on their take-home salary?
Yeah, it's really difficult to say because there's so many different variables that go into a quote. So, for example, you can have the car between 2 and 5 years with Tusker. There's a set mileage as well. So if you're doing less than no mileage and you only choose 5,000 miles a year, then clearly it's going to be cheaper for you than if you're doing 20 or 25 or even 30, etc. Also depends on the employee's age, because that will affect the motor insurance premium. So once all of those elements have gone in to make up the quotation, it's kind of an average saving for an employer's NI of about £731 a year for everyone coming into the scheme. But it's typically much more than that, even for 20% taxpayers.
Are there other things that you can actually get through a salary sacrifice scheme, or is it just electric vehicles?
Well, there's four mandated salary sacrifice schemes in the UK currently under current legislation, let's say, and that's electric cars, so ultra-low emission cars, so cars of 75 grams and below, pensions, which can be salary sacrificed, childcare, although that's kind of less on the remit of employee benefits now, and bike-to-work schemes. So those are the kind of four mandated by the government. There are other ways of doing salary sacrifice, but you don't make the NI savings with them.
Okay, that makes sense. And now I mentioned a few seconds ago about the fact that I'm sort of self-employed, and you said, no, it has to be within a company and there's got to be a minimum number of individuals employed there for the scheme to work. But is there a way of a number of different individuals banding together to create like a generic salary sacrifice company that could be used then to have a scheme applied against it?
Unfortunately not, no. So if you're self-employed, you're not being paid through a payroll, so you're not taking a salary as such, you might be taking dividends or being paid another way. It has to be through an employer to comply with HMRC salary sacrifice rules. So it has to be taken from the payroll. So the structure of the scheme is from the supplier to the employer. They're leasing the car directly from the supplier. And then the employer makes that car available to the employee in lieu of salary as a non-cash benefit. That's how it works. So the idea is that supplier has a hands-off financial arrangement with the employee directly, which doesn't happen if you're self-employed.
And is salary sacrifice only for new cars, or is there the option to get what they call pre-owned vehicles on salary sacrifice?
Typically, they are brand new cars, but in recent years, we definitely have brought our pre-loved scheme to the marketplace. So that's cars that we've got up to 3 years old that are coming back off contract that are, you know, go through a 200-point safety check. From a health and safety perspective, that's paramount. So all the cars are known to us. We know what servicing history they've had, etc. And if they are in really good condition and really low mileage, then we're repurposing those and putting them back out. So that's also helping. People can take them up to 5 years as well from that. So you could be driving a three-year car over an additional 5 years, which is much cheaper. So it's helping with National Living Wage as well, because eligibility for the scheme is one of the barriers that's been quoted by employers recently.
Talk to me a little bit about Tusker as a company and how they play in the salary sacrifice space. Because, I mean, we've talked fairly generically about salary sacrifice. What is it that Tusker offer that maybe other salary sacrifice companies don't?
So Tusker was first to market with the scheme in 2009 when the benefit in kind taxation changed, and we realised that actually it would be more advantageous for employees to drive much lower emission cars. We decided to specialise in that a long time ago. And because of that, 3 years ago, were bought by Lloyds Banking Group to be now the sole salary sacrifice provider within the transport division, which is fantastic. Mm-hmm. Tusker's USPs are, that's all we do. So we are salary sacrifice specialists. All of our systems have been built around salary sacrifice. It takes into account nuances with different pension schemes, particularly within the public sector. It only shows employees cars they're entitled to see that won't take them below National Living Wage, which is one of the key elements. Our lifestyle protection, so the risk removal, what happens if somebody leaves or goes on maternity leave, etc. Employers understandably don't want to be left with a car in the car park that they're having to pay for and can't reallocate to anybody else. So it's looking at the scheme to be employee and employer centric. So it's got to work really well for the employee, be really good value, no hassle, just, you know, ring one number when you need something done, etc. And for the employer, it's not like running a separate traditional company car fleet on the side. This is a fully outsourced employee benefit. So it's got to work for both. So that would be Tusker's USPs.
So does Tusker act as a vehicle provider, or are you just the financier of the whole scheme?
We are the financier. So what we're doing is an employee will come onto the portal. They'll run a quote on, let's say, I don't know, Ford Focus or Ford Puma, which has now just been confirmed to get the EV grant, by the way. If anybody's watching this and thinking about a car, get £3,750 off a Ford Puma. I'm not on commission for Ford. What they can do is come into the portal. We will then, once they place their order, we'll go out to the dealer network to see who has got that car in stock. So we're very much working closely with the dealer network for all manufacturers and also the manufacturers to see who can supply the car the quickest. And then we will purchase that car as part of the arrangement and have the car delivered onto the employee. So we're very much funding those cars and managing them in life, obviously.
Now, what are the big issues or questions that I like to address in the podcast is the whole topic of educating individuals who are new to electric vehicles. So you've got people on your scheme. This will be potentially the first EV they've ever taken delivery of. So who has that responsibility for ensuring that the new drivers get training on things like public charging and regenerative braking and, you know, removing the little rubber bung from the charge socket to release the high voltage pins? Who has that responsibility?
Yes, it's all really simple stuff, isn't it, when you know what to do? But if you don't know what to do, it's highly confusing. So that responsibility is down to the employee to understand what it is, because they are having a new piece of kit delivered effectively. But within the Tusker portal specifically, we have the EV hub. And what that does is explain to employees from the ground up, basically, what an electric vehicle is, how you charge it, what the public infrastructure looks like. We've got a tie-up with ZapMap, so we put them in touch with ZapMap. ZapMap have some wonderful stuff on their app as well, not just locating the right charger for your car, but some other information as well. But equally, then when the car is delivered, it's the part of the arrangement is that the delivery driver will make sure that the employee is happy and knows how to start the car. Sometimes you get in to an electric and you can't even start it. So it's like, where's the start button? I can't even find it. There's no key. So even that sometimes is a revelation to people. So we do suggest strongly in our SLAs for dealers that they do take the employee around the car and make sure they're comfortable with being able to drive it before they leave.
Okay, fantastic. Anything else you want to say about salary sacrifice before we close?
Only just to reiterate that what I said previously about it is there is no better way for an employee to get into one of these cars. It does support the government's Road to Zero strategy for 2030. We're not expecting any changes on that. Who knows? Things change on a daily basis, but we're not expecting any changes on that at all.
Yeah.
So really, if you haven't got a scheme in place, then of course, do your due diligence within the market, select a provider that can, you know, manage the risk elements, make sure that they are being employee and employer centric, and put the scheme in place and make the most of it while we can.
Wonderful. Salary sacrifice is basically a way to get an electric company car. It's provided by the company, it's owned by the company, it's insured and maintained by the company. But in order to get it, your salary is reduced by an amount each month. Now, what this does is it gives you the company car as normal, but it also reduces your tax burden. So instead of paying tax on, say, £3,000 per month, you're only paying tax on £2,500 per month, but getting a company car alongside that. If your company does sell SAC, it's worth seeing what cars they have on the list. If you can find one that fits your lifestyle, as noted above, it's well worth looking at that. For more on salary sacrifice, why not ask your employees to get in contact with Tusker, the sponsors of today's episode, and a major salary sacrifice provider. Now, we did cover salary sacrifice in great detail in episode 152, the new EV episode. Of course, if you are so inclined, you can always go out there, get yourself a dealer, and buy one. Take a big bag of cash and negotiate with the dealer and see what sort of a discount you can get. Now, remarkably few people actually do that as a way of buying a new car nowadays, but don't rule it out. However, with the current residual values of EVs, it's probably not a great thing to do. You could lose a lot of money in depreciation in the first year or so. Now, the next way of getting an electric vehicle is leasing, and there are many companies out there that will lease you an EV. My last two EVs came through Drive Electric, which is a lease company. Now, how this works is quite simple. You select the car you want from their list. You let them know the deposit you want to put down and how many months you want the lease for, and then you tell them how many miles you want to drive across the length of the lease, and they'll calculate a monthly lease cost. My first lease on the Kia Soul EV was 36 months, zero down, 12,000 miles per year, and it came to a grand total of £290 per month. My second lease, the ID3, was £1,200 down, 36 months, and 10,000 miles per year, and that came to £335. Per month. Now, there are some really good lease deals available on some cars. It all depends on supply and demand and how much the dealers who supply the cars need to sell them. Usually, at the end of a lease, you'll have to give the car back, although some type of leases give you the option to pay an amount to take full ownership of the vehicle, but not all of them do. So be aware of that. You'll have to check the terms and conditions for more details. Now, finally, there is a way that most people would get an EV, which is the second-hand car market. Now, for quite a while, the second-hand car market for EVs was quite small and prices were high. Nowadays, that's not the case. In many instances, EVs are less expensive than similar ICE cars on the second-hand market. And I have an episode coming a little later on this season talking all about buying a second-hand EV. But the short version of this is make sure you get the battery checked, make sure you test drive it, and always buy from a reputable dealer. One of the most important parts of the buying process, especially for someone who's never driven an EV before, is the test drive. Unfortunately, it's one of the least understood and misused aspects of the buying process as well, and this is for two reasons. The first reason is that people tend to equate test driving an EV with test driving a fossil fuel car, and unfortunately, they're not the same things. And secondly, dealers often have less information than the people wanting to buy the car, and this leads to all sorts of poor advice and miseducation. So let's look at these two things. Back in the day, when everyone had been driving internal combustion engine cars for years, if you wanted a new car, a test drive was great. It let you know if the car was suitable for you, whether it was comfortable, whether you could fit the dogs in the back. That's a quick nod to Laura Hustwick Wilkes from Power. And what sort of performance you could get out of it. As ICE cars were pretty much the same in terms of how they operate and what you could do with them, once you knew these things, a decision was often quite easy to make. The problem is that EVs are totally different. If you've been driving them for a while, it's fairly easy to see what you do and don't like about, say, an ID3 over a BYD Dolphin or a Polestar 2 over a Tesla Model 3. But if you've never driven an electric car before, this is much more than a test drive to see if you like the car. It's more an examination to see if it will work for you. Now, I've told this story before and I kind of mentioned it earlier on, but when I got my first EV, I borrowed a similar model from the EV Experience Centre in Milton Keynes and I ran it for a number of days. During that time, I did all the usual trips that I would do. So I did a commute, I did a trip to a specific place I visit regularly but not frequently. I did all my local runs around the area for shopping, etc., and leisure activities. I checked what the local charging was like, as well as the charging at the destinations that I usually went to. And once I'd done that, I knew I could live with an electric car, and this electric car specifically, and that's when I put down the order. But you can't do that in a 20-minute test drive. That's why you need an EV, especially if it's your first EV, ideally for about 48 hours. You need to be able to do long and short runs in it. You need to be able to see how it charges at home and how it charges on the public network. So don't go for a 20-minute test drive and make your decision solely based on that. But as well as doing that, if you get to speak to a dealer, make sure you understand whether the dealer knows about EVs and can give you good advice. Ask whether he or she drives electric themselves. Ask how many dealers at the dealership drive electric. If it's one or two out of the whole dealership, that's a sign they're not necessarily invested in electric. Ask them a simple question such as, how large is the battery? If they answer something like 77 kilowatts, you know they don't really understand what they're talking about. The correct answer is 77 kilowatt hours. It might not sound like a big difference, but if you'd asked the same dealer a similar question about a car with an internal combustion engine, what's the top speed of that car? And they answered, well, that car will top out at 155 miles per gallon. You'd seriously question whether they knew what they were talking about, wouldn't you? Now, I did a full episode on test drives back in episode 217. Again, linked in the show notes if you want to check that out. Now, that's pretty much all you need to do when thinking about an electric vehicle. Very easily, you work out whether you can live with one. You decide how you're going to get one, finance it, buy it outright, lease it, hire it, whatever. You take several of them out on extended test drives and you see if they fit your lifestyle. And you place your order. So let's do a quick recap. You've checked to see whether electric works for you. You've looked at different ways of taking ownership of one. You've test driven a couple, ideally, for more than a day or so. And you finally pulled the trigger and ordered and bought one, new or second-hand. So what comes next? Well, we'll look more into that in the next episode when we look at what happens when the car gets delivered and what to do on your first day in an electric vehicle. And that's in next week's episode. It's time for a cool EV or renewable thing to share with your listeners. Vodafone UK will complete the electrification of its 1,000-strong company car fleet by 2026, 1 year ahead of schedule. The move is part of the operator's wider strategy to achieve net zero emissions across its operations by 2030. Now, it's good to see the big companies moving forward with electrification, more so where they end up doing it ahead of schedule. So, well done, Vodafone.
The EV Musings podcast is sponsored by ZapMap, the go-to app for EV drivers, helping you find and pay for public charging with confidence. See what charge points are available right now with live availability and unrivaled UK charge point coverage at your fingertips. Pay at thousands of charge points within the app or with the ZapMap charging card. Join over a million EV drivers, download ZapMap and charge with confidence.
I hope you enjoyed listening or watching today's show. It was put together this week with the help of Cheryl Clements from Tusker. Many thanks to her for her time. If you have any thoughts, comments, criticisms or other general messages to pass on to me, I can be reached at info@evmusings.com. On the socials, I'm on Blue Sky at evmusings.bsky.social. I'm also on Instagram at evmusings, where I post those little short videos and the odd podcast extract regularly. why not follow me there? Many thanks to everyone who supports me through Patreon on a monthly basis and through coffee.com on an ad hoc basis. Now, if you enjoyed this episode, why not buy me a coffee? Go to coffee.com/evmusings and you can do just that. ko-fi.com/evmusings. Takes Apple Pay too. Regular listeners will know about my two ebooks, So You've Gone Electric and So You've Gone Renewable. Now, they're 99p each, or equivalent, and you can get them on the Kindle store on Amazon. Now, check out the links in the show notes for more information, as well as a link to my regular EV Musings newsletter and associated articles. Now, I've spoke to a few of you, and I know that you're probably driving, walking, jogging, ironing, or sat on the sofa watching this on your phone. But if you can remember and you enjoyed the episode, drop a review in iTunes, please. Like, subscribe, leave a comment on YouTube, because it really helps. Thank you very much. Now, if you've reached this part of the podcast and are still listening, thank you. Why not let me know you've got to this point by messaging me at musingsev.bsky.social with the words, "How do I love thee? Let me count the ways." 2. Hashtag, if you know, you know, nothing else. Thanks, as always, to my co-founder, Simon. You know, I learned recently that he's one of these people that can solve a Rubik's Cube without looking at him. I asked if it was something he could teach me, and he gave me an enigmatic smile, and he replied,
"Yes, it's all really simple stuff, isn't it, when you know what to do? But if you don't know what to do, it's highly confusing."
Thanks for listening. Bye.